and welcome to the Killing Kittens podcast with me, Emma Kenny, along with Killing Kittens founder and CEO, Emma Sale, and journalist, Harriet Minter. The gang's all here. Every week, we're welcoming a different guest into the studio, and this week, I'm delighted to say that our guest is Deborah James. Deborah is an author, podcaster, writer, campaigner, and also somebody who's living with cancer. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You make me sound way better than what I am.
I actually felt exhausted reading that because you're so busy. And I've got to say to anybody listening, when you walked in and described just a general day in your life, I felt like I maybe needed to go and lie down.
I think I need to lie down after my day today, but it's all good. It's all good. Living, busy living, it's better.
Tell me a little bit about your journey and also about how you've arrived at this point in time where you are doing so many things, but also living with cancer itself.
Yeah, so I am bumbling through life because I don't really have an alternative, I think. So I used to be a deputy head teacher of a secondary school.
Wow.
So I'm kind of pretty passionate about education on all levels. And then that kind of, I got blindsided at the age of 35, so nearly 3 years ago, when I was told that I had metastatic bowel cancer. So A, not what you expect from a young female, like almost the polar opposite to what anybody would associate with bowel cancer. And then B, you know, I've got two young kids. Well, they're now 10 and 12. And my entire world changed because statistically, I shouldn't even be alive today. I'm alive because of, a great medical team, a lot of luck and just getting busy living rather than waiting to die, I think is always a good strategy. And then I think I just, the educator in me wanted just to continue the conversation. Because I realised that whilst I was I had no idea what cancer looked like. And I suppose in a way, I think that's pretty naive of me to assume that it happens to other people rather than happening to me. And I suppose over the last 3 years, I've had to educate myself in terms of what living with cancer looks like, because I used to assume that you got cancer hopefully you didn't get cancer, and then maybe you went into a cancer cave and then
highly contagious
and you literally, I had these visions that you would go into this kind of hole and it emerges this like disheveled butterfly and then that would be it. But I'm now in this kind of new generation of people who are just living when they probably shouldn't be living, but then that comes with a whole host of different kind of issues and problems. So I kind of just, I suppose, created a whole new career. And that was mainly founded on education, I think. I've only realised that 3 years down the line.
That's Bowel Babe, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's my alter ego. She's way sexier and cooler than me in real life.
I've been following Bowel Babe for
ages. So Bowel Babe is my alter ego. She basically was created with the view to show that actually it's the polar opposite to what you assume bowel cancer to be like. And then hopefully by doing that, it makes people stand up and listen and go, oh, if it can happen to her, it can happen to any one of us.
I guess one of the things with KK and what Emma stands for is just kind of talking about things that are considered a taboo sometimes. Yep. And giving a face to an industry that often gets a really bad rep that is completely a juxtaposition to the reality. It sounds like when you're talking about that, that's exactly what you're trying to do regarding cancer, and particularly bowel cancer, which is one of those things that people don't talk about.
It's not a pretty one. Like, you know, I'm all up for a bit of anal, but nobody likes it as soon as you start mixing in the poo. Let's face it. So the problem that we've got is people just don't want to talk about it. And by not talking about it, the issue that we've got is I had no idea that A, it could happen to people like me. And I now know that unfortunately it's one of the largest growing cancers in people under the age of 50. And on top of that, it's the second biggest cancer killer in the country.
Because of the symptoms, people ignore the symptoms, don't they?
Yeah, they're really obvious. Embarrassed. Like they'll go to the doctors. And I think it it kind of ties in with everything in terms of people don't know their own bodies. So they might eventually go to the doctors and say, oh, I've got a change of habits down there. And you're thinking, well, what is down there? And especially for females, it's like, well, you know, front, middle, back, like what are we genuinely talking about?
Especially post babies, you don't quite know what is middle and front. And back. It's your kind of Everjoss, I call it.
Everjoss. I love that. That's hilarious. Everjoss. Yeah, I like that. But people are so, they feel almost ashamed about it. And I'm somebody who talks incredibly openly and will absolutely understand the value of education. And yet I was embarrassed to kind of talk about it. And as a result, my diagnosis was really late.
Really?
Yeah. So by the time I was diagnosed, it meant that my bowel cancer had spread. So I just now have to live with cancer. And I'm very grateful and lucky to be living with cancer.
I think when people are listening to that, they probably don't understand the suggestion of being able to live with cancer. So presumably you're talking about a terminal diagnosis that might not actually kill you because things might change. Is that right?
100%. That's a really good way of looking at it, actually. So statistically, on paper, I shouldn't be living. So statistically, only about 8% of people will survive for 5 years with what I have, which is awful. And you think, oh, that's historical data, but it's not. It's kind of even data today. And what then, essentially, I'm really lucky I'm on some kind of drugs that I've responded to. It's meant that my last scans kind of a couple of weeks ago were really positive, not really showing that much disease in my body, which kind of means that I'm in a case, it's almost like becomes a chronic illness. I know that at any point, touch wood, and she's actually touching the wood.
I'm touching it with you.
Touching it with us. It can change, and I know that. But I'm really grateful to be in the position that I'm with. But then that comes with loads of things. I've had so many operations, just too many to even think about. So each one of those operations has side effects. All my drugs have side effects, and actually navigating those side effects come with physical and emotional challenges.
So can I ask, how do those side effects affect how you feel about yourself? So you said you Val, babe, your alter ego is very sexy. You're very sexy in real life.
Yeah.
But like, how does then, is that reality, right? Because ultimately, like, I know that if I've got a bit of a cold, I'm like, everyone stay away from me. Yeah. I don't want to touch. Dealing with much, much bigger side effects, how does that affect how you feel about your body?
It's a massive challenge. So I would say it's one of the really common threads, especially with younger people and older people as well, is as soon as you're diagnosed with cancer, or any illness actually for that matter, you lose your identity and you lose your, you become that illness, even though I don't want to become that illness. Like, it's the polar opposite to what I want to happen. But the reason you become it a little bit is because physically things change. So I've had, this is just one example, you know, major operation. So I've had half of my bowel removed. So immediately, visually, you look in the mirror and you've got a big zip up and down your stomach. And, you know, it doesn't quite go back together as it used to. And then inside, like, things change. So for example, because my bowel has been resected, that will affect the way that your vagina is, because it will pull down things like that, for example. It will affect the way that you feel about your body.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and I've written, it's okay, because I've written very publicly about these things, because I think people don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And they're really, not only are they worried to talk about the cancer, they're then worried to talk about the implications of the treatment as a side effect of the cancer. Anything from, I'm not actually in medical menopause, which is weird because I have every other side effect. but a lot of people say, a lot of younger girls who maybe might be treated for breast cancer, as a result of their treatment, they're flung into menopause at a really early age. So one of my colleagues that I present with, she's in medical menopause at the age of 30. So how do you
that's
then deal?
A massive hormonal shift, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you're all over the place in terms of everything. And
just to add to you being all over the place in general.
Just to add to it generally, and
it's like a pause.
Yeah, and it's an absolute mess in terms of, especially if you're in a position where you are dating, aren't dating, wherever you might be in your relationship, and then there's days where you are suddenly all about cancer. And then there's days where you're kind of like, no, I still want to be me. I still want to be me. I still want to be sexy. I still want to dress up in high heels. And it's a constant battle.
And I guess that one of the massive issues there is that you were in a relationship and you've got kids.
Yeah.
So it's not just about the way that it alters your life, because you're a mother. So I instantly know how that must feel for you, just knowing that you've got to live at all costs. I just get that that will be there. Yeah. But how has it changed the relationships that you have?
Oh, 100%. So I've spoken really, I mean, just to flung this out there. So I've spoken really honestly about my marriage as well. So I'm married with a couple of kids. But the year before I got cancer. Me and my husband actually separated.
Wow.
So to throw into this equation the fact that actually I'd come off the back of a year of Tinder into then deciding to try to make our marriage work to three weeks later being told I had metastatic
3 weeks
cancer.
Later.
So it was a month later, yeah.
Wow.
And so if you imagine then being in a situation where you're dealing with getting a marriage, trying to rebuild a marriage, deal with cancer, and a couple of kids, like, if truth be told, that's a bit of a head screw.
And with the marriage bit, you don't know, well, am I now making decisions because I've been diagnosed with cancer? Is he staying with me because I've been diagnosed with cancer?
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
So imagine, and I you know, I'm not speaking, I mean, I have to be careful because I'm always very, like, honest about saying, oh yeah, well, this is what I think, and I forget there's two people in the relationship.
I'm like that with my husband.
The downside of dating anyone with any sort of media or journalism, it's like you're going to talk about your relationship and just assume that everything I say is true for both of
us. Yeah, you forget that there's two sides to every story. But I just think it flings everything up in the air. And it's if truth be told, it is absolutely impossible to get it right. I don't think anyone can get it right. And then, yeah, you're left feeling like an inadequate mother one day, like an awful wife the next. I just think, and then some days you feel on top of the world, but I don't think you can win, actually, to be honest with you.
I don't think you can win anyway.
I don't think you can.
If you're, if you work and a mum, and I think, you know, I feel guilty the whole time. So thank God I haven't got cancer in the mix.
I used to before cancer as well. And you just feel like rubbish. So,
Claire, did your diagnosis change? I don't want to put again words in his mouth, but do you think it changed how your husband saw you?
Yeah, 100%. I think it changed our role. I think, and I think this is a real challenge, actually, and I'm not sure, I certainly don't have the answers to it, but I think what's quite common is that relationship flips from a kind of sexual partner, a kind of equal relationship, well, you hope it is in that way, to something that becomes almost like a adult-child relationship,
carer,
or like a carer relationship. And he, for is not my carer. You know, I don't need a carer at the moment. And you know, if anything, my mum will bring me soup if I need soup.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, leave that door open. It's our mother's right.
I was going to say, it's much better, isn't it? But I think the problem is that suddenly if you've got somebody that you're having a relationship with and actually you're worried because you've seen them in pain one moment or you've seen them with tubes out of them the next, or you've seen them crying at 3 o'clock in the morning, how do you then, and I remember writing about this literally the other day, saying how do you become like the lover, the partner, the husband, the father, the everything, all at the same, the carer, all at the same time.
Yeah. And also, how do you relinquish control as a very powerful woman and allow them to even enter that space? Because that's the problem as well with women, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we also, a lot of the time, inhabit our own worlds to the point where there isn't that much room because we're just doing it anyway.
I'll just get busy. I'm fine. I'll carry on doing it. And you just like block people out quite often. But yeah, I think I'm only kind of looking at this stuff probably now 3 years down the line, because I think the first year of any form of diagnosis, you're almost in shock.
Trauma.
You're in trauma and you're kind of just, you're in survival mode. So you're kind of like drawn together. And then 3 years down the line, you're suddenly like, oh, how do I live? So now you're trying to, I would say it's probably more challenging now than it ever has been, because suddenly you're like, no, I want to still be sexy and I want to be seen as desired.
And then he's probably seen you, well, you would automatically, wouldn't you, as being quite fragile.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to hurt her and, I'd, you know, rather than I'm going to throw you all over the bedroom. And
exactly. Yeah. So, and actually, I'm not sure how, I think it's a massive challenge how you get back into those roles. I don't have the answers to
it's
it.
It's about redefining them, isn't it? Because you can't be the person you were 3 years ago.
No.
And I guess that one of the things that I'm hearing when you're talking, I'm sure that Harriet and Emma agrees, is, I mean, I'm dealing with trauma at the moment. I've lost my father really traumatically. So I'm in that space. And what I'd say is that in life, you're presented with these horrible situations and there's two ways to go, isn't there?
Yeah.
It can either just drown you or it can create you. And you just sound like you've been in, don't get me wrong, a reactive space where you've just had to fucking do it.
Yes, fight.
But you're also in a really creative space. What do you feel have been the big learning experiences for you? Because I think cancer gets a bad rep. Of course it does. It can kill us.
Yeah, yeah.
But surely it's also got lessons that if you learn, they can be pretty incredible.
I was thrown out of my comfort zone. So I was on a massive trajectory to headship, and that's what I wanted to do. And I kind of never really stepped outside of that comfort zone, even though I was really ambitious in what I was doing. I never really stopped to think if I wanted to do anything else. And suddenly, because of cancer, I was then flung out of this kind of career path that I had built for me for like the next 20 years. And I had to restart. I had to kind of go, well, what do I want to do? And I have actually just fallen into stuff. But at the same time, you realise, A, without sounding cheesy, you can, if you want to do something, just say yes and see what happens. But also your skill sets, like, you know, I've written a book. I didn't think I would write a book. I've done stuff I didn't think I could do. But as a result of it, because I've become probably much more independent, much more, I think I'm like, not prouder of who I am, but I think actually I'm surprised by my own ability. It means that, say, those people close to me, like my husband, I probably rely on them a lot less. So I've become so much more independent.
They might not like sometimes, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so I've become so much more independent in terms of actually, I'm not saying I don't need those people in my life. 100% need those people, but it's about wanting them rather than needing them. So
you've also created an amazing community around you. So you've built a kind of community through your podcast, you've built your community through your social media. What do you see within that community? I don't want to say trends around sex with cancer, but like,
you know, hashtag sex with cancer.
Literally what you just said. Yeah.
But like, do you think that, do people talk about it? Like when you are talking to your counsellor, you know, do they talk to you about it? Do you get any help and support around it? Or is it just like, no, that's part of your life that's done that?
So I write a weekly column, and the biggest read weekly column that I've ever written was around sex with cancer. And the reason is because, and again, I was talking about this the other day, when you think about it, if you are, say, somebody living with metastatic cancer or any disease for that matter, you've got, what, 10 minutes, half an hour with your doctor, if you're lucky. And you've probably got a massive list of actual kind of things that are kind of like, right, you know, my toilet habits are this, and this scar is, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah. And sex and relationships is probably bottom of the list. And I guarantee you, you probably don't get to that. And as a result, you forget the how it can impact on your quality of life. And it's one of those things in terms of, like, you've got the taboo of cancer and then talking about sex and cancer. Well, that's just taboo, really, isn't it? And you find that men are a little bit better, apparently. I was speaking to, I do some lectures with kind of trainee doctors. And apparently they find that men are better at speaking about it because they can physically say, oh, I'm impotent because of this operation, for example.
And it's probably more, to them, it's more their identity. Oh, you know, I mean, sex to men, whereas women can, because our biggest sex organ is our brain, we can actually cut it off and go for
and
years without
down.
And the desire goes. Yeah. And whereas I think men, they just don't have that. So actually it's top of their list.
It's top of their list. Yeah. And apparently they're much more forward with saying, right, I've had this operation, therefore I'm impotent. What can we do about it? Whereas women almost get to the point, and I kind of feel this with me actually. So I probably, for the first year of my diagnosis, shut down any of my sexuality. And I'm quite a sexual person in that it's always, I'm the biggest flirt I know, actually, if I'm being honest with you. But sex has always played quite an important part in making me feel confident about myself and making me feel secure about myself as well, in a safe environment. But then I would say you get a diagnosis and you don't prioritise it. And then what then happens is that when you then have to live with cancer, you then suddenly go, oh, I'm missing this massive part of my life. And it's not even the sex, it's the intimacy that comes with it, because you've essentially shut down that whole aspect of your life. And I would say, people don't talk about it. And there's lots of, there's the physical side. So for example, anybody who might have any form of cancer or disease that might be, say, in their lower half of their body, they may have had radiotherapy or operations that will physically change their internal organs. And so that could be anything from like a shortening of their vagina, which is really common, to pain because of kind of scar tissue, whatever it might be. Then, for example, people who might have had mastectomies, it's how they feel about their bodies. And people just don't talk about it at all. And yet, I think it's so important. But how do you... I don't have the answer. Does that make sense? I don't have the answers, but I feel it's a massive area that people kind of go, oh, you are ill, therefore we don't need to talk about sex. You don't have sex when you're ill. Do you have sex when you're ill? Nah, don't worry about it. It's fine.
And I think also particularly for women, like you said, for men, we assume that they have a sex drive and therefore this is going to be a problem for them and we should address it.
And
on
if
the
they
list
can't
of
get it up, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like Viagra being thrown out there. And I'm like, you know,
I mean, I
whereas
guess
if women are dry and have issues down there, it's like, so what, Anne?
And that's it. I think because we've got an easy medical solution, we're like, here, go take some Viagra. So that's an easy conversation. Whereas we don't assume that women have a sex drive or a need or a desire. And so we don't talk to them about it.
Yeah. And yet, funny enough, so I would say at the moment, the last like 6 months, because I've got to the point where my disease is stable, it's really interesting because suddenly you feel quite liberated from your disease and therefore your sex drive suddenly comes back. And it's really weird because then you're left in a place where you've suddenly got a sex drive again, but you haven't got necessarily the right relationships around you to support that need because those relationships have changed.
Mm.
And so then you're left in a situation which is kind of just sexually frustrated.
it's crazy.
I'm now suddenly realising, I'm just not going to tell my husband.
But it is
crazy,
isn't it, that you're not getting that kind of support as well? Because the fact is that you have come through something where for the first year you were just thinking, I'm going to die. That's the thing. The first year, I'm going to die. It's all about my death. This is it. The second year, it's like, I'm going to survive. Then it's like, I've plateaued. I'm okay.
Yeah.
Shit.
I'm still here.
I've not got a plan for that.
I've not got a plan. How do I get busy living?
Right. And like, that's
what do I do?
A really challenging place to be. And so your relationship has gone through a fast track of development, hasn't it? You got back together. You got cancer. You stayed together. Now you're actually still here, and those horrible things that you all imagine were going to happen, planning the funeral, don't need to happen. And it's now about, like you said, you know, you're into education, you want to educate the medical field and everything, but how much are you tending to your own needs and how much are you spending? That's really a question. Like, how much time are you and your partner spending on visiting intimacy?
Yeah, not enough. At all, I have to be really honest.
Can you take yourself out? Because like sometimes if you get stuck in the same environment and the environment you're in and been living in has had it all, you know, is the carer environment. Yeah. Do you have to sort of make a real effort and go, do you know what, we're going to take ourselves out to something completely new.
Yeah.
New underwear, new, you know what I mean? And just let's do something. I'm not saying come to KK.
No, I would go, like to.
All come.
Yeah.
But you get that. So you just, it's just us.
Yeah, no, because but I think it is a real challenge. I think I think you have to try to make an effort to, but I can't say it would always work. Does that make sense? Because I think, and I think the other people that I've spoken to, so when they speak really honestly, they'll say, yeah, you know, we're not in a sexual relationship or, well, you know, we're more in like a care relationship. But then when I think about it from the flip side of the coin, if I was my husband right now, I'd probably be elsewhere.
Yeah.
If I'm being really honest with you, because actually, you know, how do you, if you've got somebody who's dealing, so, okay, think about it in role reverse. Mm. If you've got somebody who is emotionally, say, ill, you don't want to then impart your kind of like intimate needs onto them.
Sure.
And so you suddenly shut that down as well from the other side. So it's kind of, it's...
You were just saying then when we brought in the idea about KK. So do you have a connection to KK? Are you interested in
Exploration? Actually. So I'm going to be really honest. Mm. So I'm really interested in it, but I've never... It's one of those really weird things, isn't it? And I don't know how people in my situation... Because I know that you have couples that come as well.
We've got lots of women on their own.
Do you?
Yeah,
but then it's really challenging, isn't it? So if you're in a marriage like me, how do you if you then have one partner who says, you know, hang on a moment, I quite want to do something. I want to be married to you, right? And so I know that I want to be married to you, and I don't want to be in a random Tinder situation. Yeah. But I also know that there's two times in my life where I feel totally liberated. Not only two times, but there's two strands when I feel really liberated. One is when I'm having really good sex, and the other time is when I'm running.
Yeah.
And so actually, and that's true actually. So there's these two strands.
Totally get it.
So I run quite a lot.
Like yeah. Forrest Gump, I'm just running. I'm still running.
Just going to run.
Absolutely.
So then it's really challenging, isn't it? Because you're kind of like, okay, maybe I could do this, but actually then do you risk your marriage to do stuff? I think that's quite I don't know, do people...
We get a lot of couples like that. I think initially it is having that conversation.
Yeah.
And sometimes, we have couples where actually the women come on their own and actually, they've got that agreement and the husbands know that that's just what
they do.
They don't feel threatened because they know it's just a sex kind of thing. We always have couples who come together, you know, to the event, and the woman is bi-curious or bisexual. Yeah. And again, you have that. There's so many different dynamics. But then we also have, you know, couples that come along and neither of them do anything sexual with anyone. It's just that feeling empowered, and mainly, and you saying with your scars and stuff, to actually dance around in your underwear.
Feel
accepted with no judgment, and to feel that you are the most beautiful person there, and that's enough then to actually go away and have amazing sex with the other half.
There's different
energies.
With your situation,
yeah,
is there a part of you as well that's just thinking to yourself, you know, screw this, I have got one life. You've had your mortality challenged.
Yeah.
Is this now about you thinking, you know what? No, I'm going to just try everything, do anything, try to create something really positive in my relationship. And you want to stay with him.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you don't want to explore further.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, so weirdly, I value my relationship with my husband more so since I've had cancer.
That.
Because actually, it's not... Sex is a part of it, but it's actually so much more complicated than that. And actually, you have to value the history and the complexities of that. But I've also recognised the challenges that it's thrown at you. And I'm not sure one person can fulfil every single need. Mm. And I don't just mean this on a sexual level. I just, you know, what I recognise more is that I now use my friends in a different way since I've had cancer. So I emotionally rely a lot on my friends, not because my husband can't do it. It's just, how can I load all of that on one person?
I say that anyway to people. A lot of people put too much pressure on husband or boyfriend and expect them to actually tick every single box. And I'm like, you've got, you know, I don't. I've got so much, you know, different friends for different things, and you have different conversations with different people. And you can understand actually why, and that's why I get a lot of the sort of KK dynamics in couples is actually they can see that they don't tick every box on that level, and actually they respect that in each other, and so you have that understanding. So
In a way, I think it's really common actually. So I was speaking to some of my medical team the other day, just about a few challenges, and they said that actually it's incredibly common that they will see in longer term cancer patients that their marriages or their relationships will break down.
They said
that actually it's more common, it's very, very commonplace. They also said it's, you know, this is almost it. To be honest with you, I haven't looked up whether there's even any data on it.
There's some interesting data on the way that hormones impact on us. So there's some really amazing research and some books out at the moment that, for example, if you're taking the pill and you come off the pill, you stop being attracted to your partner because it changes the hormones, which completely changes the chemical balances and actually stops you feeling as attracted to the people that you might have been attracted to whilst you were on it. When you have cancer treatment, it massively affects your hormone system.
Yeah.
So even though... without the treatment, you might have felt massively like a raging woman wanting to rip your husband's back off. If you've been affected in any way, it can literally transcend your attraction level to the people that you would once have found attractive. And that is actually something that we can see neurochemically. So you will have had so much happen to you that you might look at him and think, you just remind me of my dad. And it's not even that he reminds you of your dad. It's that your brain has changed.
He smells
different. You feel different. And I think that women put such a pressure on themselves to go, well, it's a failing on me if I can't find that sexual connection anymore. But often it's not. When you've gone through what you've been through with chronic illness, it's very, very common. So it's how you start to rebuild those structures. So when you're thinking about KK and going to Curious Kittens, for example, with your clothes on, having conversations with people there, and also helping your husband to see that this is about you two moving to a new plane, a new
together.
Position.
Because the thing that I... like, weirdly, like, the reason I'm more curious about, say, KK than it's in a way, I think it's I don't want people to go off and have affairs.
Yeah.
And actually, in a way, correct me if I'm wrong, but mechanisms like that is almost stopping those affairs. Well,
that's what it's always been. That's what it's always been a massive part of it, is that to me, it's communicating.
Yeah.
And not having that. And and I've always said, you know, it's always grated me that sort of we've been judged as being seedy and whatever, but it's totally okay for a guy to shag their secretary. I mean, that's more socially acceptable than actually a couple who have communicated and agreed to that it's all right to mutually go to a kitten's party. And even if they don't do anything with anyone else, they're still judged for going. So, yeah.
There's also something about being in that environment allows you to feel and see people differently. I don't know, but I feel like...
You've still got to come. She's never been there.
I know. We're going to have to do a podcast episode after I go.
After you and Deborah go.
We should.
I wonder if lots of people come, don't do anything at the party, and then go home and have sex. Because
Definitely.
Loads, because that's insane. It's the environment, actually. And I remember going out with... Guys, I say guys, ages ago. I never really had, up until my husband, a relationship longer than a year and a half, and I've been with him 7 years, and Kitten's been going 14 years. So there's been a load of boyfriends that I held hands with. And I was doing KK, and often, you know, I'd be working. Back then, I had male friends doing the bar and stuff, but you'd get so turned on in that environment, even though I was working, that actually when you then left
and go
you
home,
just sort of you didn't, half the time you didn't make it through the front door. It was sort of, it's just because it's just the whole atmosphere is enough.
See, the thing, this is something I haven't said before, so but it's I think it's okay to say it. Before we separated, essentially he was not being that well behaved. I mean, our marriage had basically run to a ground, and this was before cancer. But I was essentially, for want of a better word, having an emotional affair with somebody.
Yeah. Right?
But it was purely emotional. There was nothing physical in it, but it was 100% emotional. However, the weird thing is that our marriage at that point in time was really good.
Yeah.
And it was actually only when that emotional affair stopped a year later did we then actually separate.
Wow.
Fascinating.
And it's so weird. So I can kind of, I don't know how similar it is, but I think there is some similarities in terms of
we need different people for different things.
And on that bombshell indeed. That's about it for this episode of Killing Kittens. Thank you so much for listening. Emma, Harriet, as always, just so interesting. I'm sure that many people want to get you two in a room on your own. Thanks to this week's guest, Deborah James, who've been absolutely amazing. Literally, Deborah, it's one of those where I don't think that in such a short amount of time we can even scratch the surface and do justice to somebody like yourself. You come in here with more energy than all three of us put together. And, you know, I'm not going to use the term warrior in the context of battle. I know that you're really against that you want people to feel that they're not fighting, they're just living with. Yeah. But it's inspiring to see that still you are that educator and you are obsessed with making sure that people learn more and understand more about cancer and living with cancer.
Thank you
so much. Please don't forget to get in touch with us if you've got any questions, which I'm sure you will have. Please email. yeah, exactly. Maybe you want to know what happens when Deborah actually does attend Killing Kittens. We'll see.
That'll be in her column.
It's going to be three podcasts dedicated to that. Simple as. Please do get in touch with us by emailing kittens@thepodcastworks.com. Or you can message us on Twitter @killingkittens. And if you've liked what you've heard, which you better have because it's been brilliant, please do feel free to subscribe. And if you fancy it, give us 5 stars. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.